Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here in the second hour. And as I just said a moment ago, let me tell you more about that. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ Baltimore's Credit Union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ Baltimore's Credit Union is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you and money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com. Or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. So, you know, we looked at this the other week. I had an email from somebody talking about this rezoning happening in Baltimore, the first rezoning of Baltimore since 1971. So first I looked at this and went, who are these people? And people on this list, and I said, they're developers. I didn't trust them immediately. So that was my first reaction. And then I said, well, let me read about this a bit more. And I said, this could be a really good show, but could this really be boring just to talk about zoning? And I can see people yawning and going to sleep. However, what we're talking about here is the first total revamping of Baltimore's zoning codes and laws since 1971. And as Mayor Pat Clark was quoted in the newspaper the other day, saying that when the argument of why is it taking so long, one of the things she said, she's in our studio now, was said was that this zoning code is like a Bible for the city of Baltimore. It has to do with what we can and cannot do for the next X period of time. And so many of us will not even be here, and we're pushing up grass. So it's that.
I don't remember saying that.
No, I said the last part.
Yes,
I said
right,
that.
But it's
so,
true.
But it's that important. It has to do with what can be in your neighborhood, what commercial zones can or cannot be in your neighborhood, what
right.
defines a family. How we build a community and more. And I have many questions that I don't see in this that I want to ask. All right, looking forward to you joining us because this is your town hall on this at 410-319-8888. Write to us here, talk@steinershow.org. You can also tweet me at Mark Steiner, jump on our Facebook pages, but do call in 410-319-8888. And looking forward to having you join that conversation. We are here in the studio with Rich Hall, Executive Director of the Citizens Planning and Housing Association, former Secretary of Housing for the state. Good to have you here, Rich.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Great to be here, Mark.
Al Berry is Principal of AB Associates, a land planning firm in Baltimore, and a steering committee member of the Baltimore Development Work Group. Good to have you back. It's been a long time, Al. Good to see
great.
You.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Mark.
Councilwoman Mary Pat Clark is in the house as well, and who has been quoted on this great deal. Good to see you, Councilwoman,
nice to
once
be
again.
Here. Thank you.
Councilman Carl Stokes is joining us by phone. He has a family journey to make, but he can join us by phone. Carl, good to have you with us as well.
Great to be with you, Mark, and my colleague, Mary Pat, and your other guest.
And Drew Schmidt-Perkins is in the studio. She used to be a constant guest on the show for like 10 years. It's been a long time since she's been here. It's good to have her back. She's executive director. She has been for a while. 1,000 Friends of Maryland. Good to have you here, Drew.
Thank you, Mark.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. So let me just begin by kind of defining this for a moment. I guess if I could, Drew, mind if I start with you?
Sure.
I mean, I for our listeners, because this has really not been covered. There was one article in the Sunday Sun. I didn't see much in the Brew, didn't see much in the city paper, didn't see much in many places about this rezoning. And so here it's popping in, but this is really critically important. So talk a bit about what this is that we are wrestling or not publicly wrestling with very much.
Right. I think when you say zoning, people instantly zone
they
out.
They do. They zone out.
I mean, it is completely this mysterious, hard to understand, convoluted.
Right.
Lots of things like R2, R14, conditional use, overlays, PUDs, TUDs, I don't know.
They make the language purposely boring.
It is tough. It's tough. Yet, at the very, very fundamental core, zoning is what makes your neighborhood strong or weak. Zoning is what makes it easy or hard for different kinds of development to come in. Zoning is what allows or disallows a level of participation and involvement. And it's the very fundamental part, the design structure, the bones of how a community is built, rebuilt, and comes together. And Baltimore now is at that very pivotal point where we're a very, very old city with a lot of challenges. And this is the moment where we need those bones to work to strengthen our communities, to make it easy to bring in high-quality new development that meets the needs of our communities, brings jobs in, makes the community stronger, makes it reasonably easy for these to happen, for good things to happen, reasonably hard for bad things to not not happen. Bad things to make it hard for bad things to happen. That's what I want to say. Improves the citizen participation in the process and makes it a lot easier for everybody to understand what's going on and ways to engage.
Let me just add that basically the zoning code is important to people, very important, when all of a sudden they're faced with development. So that's when it's important. And I totally agree with everything that you've said, Drew. And I just wanted to add that in because
critical. That's
where...
That's critical.
Yeah. I mean, all of a sudden, people school themselves on what their rights are, what their rights aren't, how to go about it, who can they be, you know, how to get part of the process. So transparency... inclusion, proper notice, proper open government, open meetings are also part of what we're looking at very hard in the draft as we begin our amendment process. Because access, when you need it, it's like that old definition of family. A family is a place then that when you have to go there, they have to take you in. Well, zoning code is a place that when you have to go there, they should let you in.
So,
right.
So, go ahead, Carlman.
Yeah, if I could jump in just a minute. Of course, I agree what has been stated. But, of course, because it's been 44, 45 years since we had this comprehensive rezoning, it now has become very difficult for both residents and businesses to change what is going on in the land. For example, there used to be oil tanks where there now is a shopping center down at Canton Crossing that was zoned for whatever it was. There was a manufacturing zoning where Procter & Gamble was, where now is Under Armour. And so now we ought to, as we're doing, change great swaths of land and be able to put in zoning that speaks to the uses currently as well as a short predictor of uses to come, so that people who come in don't have to go through a long, rigorous process for each address and take years sometimes to do something that is going to be very good for not only for the citizens, but also great for the economy. And so changing the zoning in a more comprehensive way right now is also critical because we don't want folks that have to come in for each and every address and take months and just too long a time to do something that will increase our livability, our amenities, and our economic viability.
So let me turn to this letter that was sent out and talk about where the issues are here and why there's so many kind of problems here and where the arguments take place around this. There's a letter that was sent out by the group that represents three of our folks in this audience, Drew, Alan, Rich, and Rich, and it was Transform Baltimore City Council Bill 12-0152. So where are the bones of contention here? I mean, this bill has been in with the City Council since 2012. Am I right about that?
We began our hearings back. I wrote this down so I'd know this for sure. The City Council began its meetings on this 382-page volume in September of 2013. We had public hearings, 10 of them, out in the community except for two, which were in City Hall. People testified. We went through the whole code. And then we began our public work sessions page by page in January of 14.
So let me get to the nitty-gritty here of some of the questions. And so let's begin by this battle over the question of what a family is in terms of zoning. And this is important. I want you to weigh in here, 410-319-8888. So right now the family means that no more than four people can be living in together. In
unrelated.
Unrelated can be living in a house. Some council people, I think Mary Pat, you're one of them. If I'm right, correct, don't put words in your mouth. You've never let me with anyway.
I won't. enough words in my own mouth.
That's true.
To go around.
So that to make it just two people. not four.
I put that amendment in, but that was just to get the conversation going, frankly.
So,
and we've had lots of other discussions since then, and I think we – basically, it was just to say, look, that's what Baltimore County does. Don't tell us we can't do that legally. But then there are – and it was really about fraternities and sororities.
So what's the issue for you, Al, in this?
Well, let me explain from a background standpoint that I started in the city in 1971 when the new zoning code at that time, which took 10 years for the council to adopt. So in that sense, we're going to beat that, I hope, if we adopt it this year. And the old zoning code had a lot of definitions in it, a lot of old uses such as stamp redemption centers. Does anybody remember what those are?
Sounds like a good idea.
So the new code is a way to bring it into the 21st century to create more flexibility both for the development community, which I'm representing here today, Baltimore Development Work Group, who's been monitoring the zoning code with the city and all the groups at this table to try to be sure that the code itself doesn't keep being talked about and debated for another couple of years, but really gets done hopefully by this year, because there are, from our standpoint, a number of developments that are being held up in the city because they were predicated on the new code being adopted, and it's been a wait.
As in what?
As in these are properties that are industrial properties, as Councilman Stokes mentioned, that might be transferred into an office mixed-use complex. Vacant industrial buildings that the zoning may not allow that to happen the way that the Under Armour campus was transformed.
Like where? Can you be specific?
No, I can't give you specific properties right now because I'm not representing any. But there are developers that we're aware of that have come into the city, and the city says you have two choices. You can rezone the property now to an office classification or a planned unit development, or you can wait till transformed Baltimore.
They should go with a PUD.
Wait. So let me ask a question here. This is part of the issue that I wanted to raise and have all you answer this very specifically, and then we'll go to our first caller, 410-319-8888. So, like, there's this debate. It's that when you talk about empty shells, people want to rebuild. A lot of those empty shells are in very poor neighborhoods at the moment.
I'm sorry.
A lot of those empty shells are in poor neighborhoods, abandoned warehouses on the east side, right near where I'm pointing to over here, because this is, that's our Clayton Geit was here from Rose and Ashland on the east side. There are tons of buildings, as you can see from train tracks, or just driving around communities and visiting people, that they're in those neighborhoods. Poor neighborhoods, mostly poor black folks in those neighborhoods.
Sure.
Most of the developers are not black people, and most of those developers aren't in those neighborhoods. And so when we make zoning easy for people, I want to know what that means for the people in those neighborhoods. That's what I want to know. Because, you know, when you sit – and I've been saying this a lot right lately, that somebody said to me the other day, what is your definition for any project that opens in the city? My definition is, does it help end poverty in Baltimore? If it doesn't answer that question, then why are we doing it? So I want to know, what does the zoning mean when it comes to that?
Well, one thing it means in my district.
I just want to get some other voices in here we haven't heard from it.
Hi.
Come right back to you, Mary Pat. Rich?
Well, this is Rich Hall, and I think that's a great question, is that we do need to be looking at who's benefiting from new development projects. And I think many can make a strong argument that any development in the city is good because we're desperate for it. But I think you can see certain parts of the city that are obviously growing much faster.
Again, you have to ask questions. Excuse me for interrupting, Rich. Good for who?
Right. So you got to look at – there's different parts of the city that have stronger versus weaker markets. And I think when it comes to planning in general and looking at this rezoning – a lot of what we keep talking about is, this development project and that development project, or even at a block scale. And as a career planner, one of the reasons these things get a little foggy and boring for folks is the whole idea is to look at the city as a whole, as a total, which is one of the reasons we need transform, because it'll help to eliminate some of the piecemeal nature in which rezonings are looked at, conditional uses, and those types of things. It's the whole We're supposed to look at the city as a whole. So who is benefiting from certain projects? Where is it? And what can we do to ensure that when some of the poorer parts of the neighborhood, as you mentioned, Mark, are being redeveloped, some to empty shells, as you referred to some of the buildings, can that be done in a way that the people that live adjacent to the building in that neighborhood benefit and aren't displaced? The whole term gentrification. Gentrification done right can be a good thing. We have to be very, very careful with it because we don't want to create one problem by trying to solve another.
And Carl, what were you about to say? Then I'll jump back into the studio.
No, I'm okay. I agree with that. I agree that your question, if it doesn't help to erase poverty, why do it? Or what's the purpose of it? As you've seen in the EBDI area, for example, where we redeveloped and we changed zoning laws, all we did there so far is to move black people out of their neighborhood. 800 families who were owning or had rented for a long time in properties. We have not built one new house for any of the persons that were moved out of East Baltimore. All we've done is created more acreage for Johns Hopkins and other institutions, mostly Johns Hopkins. That's all we did was increase their footprint another four blocks north of the original campus, and we moved out African Americans. And they're never coming back at all, ever, because that was decided at the beginning of this venture some 12 years ago, and they've won. And I am very angry about it, and others are also, Mark.
So let me ask this question very specifically about two different parts of this bill that people are arguing about. And one has to do with this campus zone, which is the argument around what hospitals, universities, and secondary schools and what can be built around them, and who makes those decisions about what they are and where they are, whether it's – because you can see it happening all around us right now, whether it's over here at Hopkins University where the new construction going up there, or even here at Morgan State University across the street on Perham Parkway. So what is the argument here about campus zoning?
It's about – I think the basic argument is it's called educational campuses, and there's two categories, secondary, like a Gilman, et cetera, school, and EC2, which is universities and colleges. And basically, those that are engaged in the discussion, the draft basically would have the colleges, for example, submit a master plan that gets approved, and then after that, as I read the text, after they have their master plan, they can then proceed to do what they wish. And the question is, well, what if they wish to do something that is not anticipated and impacts the neighborhood? We should have a right to come back in and have a say. So I think we're getting that resolved. I don't think it's a big controversy. I think we're working with the high schools and the colleges, and coming to agreements, frankly.
Julie Donnell.
If I could just weigh in a little bit of this, this is one of the things that we're trying to fine-tune. We're trying to make it easy for these incredible institutions that are so important to Baltimore. Our anchor institutions are often called the hospitals, the universities, these places that play such a big role economically, to make it easy for them to thrive, but not at the expense of the neighborhoods. And finding that balance of making them able to do the kind of development and redevelopment, but having the right neighborhood involvement, it's a lot like an agreement that was formed a number of years ago around Loyola College, in which I think five or six neighborhood associations and Loyola have come – they have an agreement to help that university, now university, thrive, but not have them take over and
right.
decimate our neighborhoods. Living in that neighborhood, it's made a big difference. And this campus zone is very much based on that type of model.
Mm-hmm.
But this is part of where the amendments, 800,000 amendments that the council people are facing.
25% of those are from the very planning department that wrote the draft.
Right. No, I mean, a lot of them are technical, but there's a lot of amendments.
Well, no, they're more than technical from that.
I'm sorry, Council. What I'm trying to say is there's a lot of amendments that are coming in that will help you know, through the hearings, through the discussions, we know the way that we need to move forward on this. But it's a lot of work, and it's going to require a lot of finesse to make sure we find those balance, and I hate using that term because it's often used for evil purposes, the balance between the economy and the environment when both need to thrive. But I think there is a balance here.
But we have to.
Well, BDW would echo what Drew just mentioned here in the sense that these anchor institutions provide a lot of jobs in the city. They're a growing job base for the city, and that a new zoning code for the entire city should not hamstring these institutions, which, frankly, at the moment, under the current zone, are permitted uses. And so hospitals.
What does that mean?
Well, permitted uses means that with certain restrictions maybe on height or size and setbacks to existing neighborhoods, they have to conform to that, but they are considered a permitted use. So that when Hopkins Schools. University wants to go buy a piece of property on or near their campus, they know that they have the zoning to allow them to build a new academic a new academic building. And that's important from a predictability standpoint for any institution to at least be seen as something that the city wants to have happen. The debate that's going on, and this is throughout the entire zoning code process, really comes about as to who approves these types of uses. Are these uses that are expanded, are they going to be required to go to the zoning board? Are they going to be required to be seen as a continued permitted use? Or does the city council have to actually approve each of these new expansions for schools or hospitals?
Can I just say something? You guys want us to hurry up and pass the planning staff's and commission's draft. We didn't, in the city council, create ECs. The planning commission did, in concert with the colleges and universities. I mean, they want it. And so we have it in front of us. We didn't come up with that. So we're trying to create from that the balance you're talking about. But this was coming from this is what we should hurry up and do. And there's a lot of other issues in here that we're trying to cope with and understand. And also, we have constituents, and we're answerable to those constituents about what these institutions do and don't do. So, yeah, but golly day, there's been so many conversations going on that I cannot believe we are not going to come to a place in this code where it's amended where there's some consensus because
– if I could just sort of put a context for this letter that we sent.
Yeah.
Because we don't mean it to be an attack in any way. And I'm sorry if it felt that way. What we felt, and I think Mark said in the very beginning, there's been a lot of conversations in a quiet way and an important way happening in your hearing rooms, in some communities. But largely the community doesn't really know that it's out there and happening, and it is so critical. And we need to get it done before the election happens. And this was an opportunity for a whole bunch of us to get together and say, wait a minute, where do we have agreement on this to make it easier for the people who are going to be voting on this to see the areas that a vast, diverse group of people have agreement on. And we felt that that would be helpful to you all to see that groups as disparate as this developer group headed by Al and John Laria and Thousand Friends of Maryland environmental groups and church groups all are agreement on these issues. Well, we were hoping that would be helpful, as well as getting some important publicity for this issue and expanding the conversation like we're doing here, like it happened in the Baltimore Sun and some other articles. So that was the reason for for this letter to you all.
So we have to take a very brief break, and we're going to come right back and also open the phone to you. Clarence, you're the first caller up. We're going to come to your call at 410-319-8888 with Rich Hall, Al Berry, Drew Schmidt-Perkins, and our two council members here, Carl Stokes and Mary Pat Clark. 410-319-8888. Your thoughts. We're going to talk about liquor stores and that more and get back to where we were just talking about here. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Stein as we examine the zoning changes in Baltimore taking place. It may be done by the end of this term, and the council people are arguing for it. We'll see where that goes. We're joined by two council members here, Carl Stokes and Mary Pat Clark, and Rich Hall, Al Berry, Andrew Schmidt-Perkins, all of whom are working to put together the document to push the changes for zoning in our city. And the arguments and discussions taking place, 410-319-8888 is the number here. Clarence, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Steiner. Good morning.
Good morning.
You know, very respectfully, this is what a lot of people in the city would call the city council aiding and abetting poverty. Anybody can walk into a neighborhood and find an existing building, which once was a single family home, chop it up into apartments and cram as many people
Amen.
In as they want to. So, you know, people do not want to live like that. You know, if you have an existing property, you should not be allowed to come in, chop it up into apartments, put as many people in there, reap the benefits off of that, and then go live somewhere else. It does not make sense. That's why I myself personally call it aiding and abetting poverty, you know. And as far as when you define those houses
right.
that are like that, I would give them 5 years to turn them back into single family. And it decreased the density in the neighborhood, which would have probably have an effect on crime and all of the below. And as far as the institutions, respectfully, I say these institutions like John Hopkins, they're operating like they're their own city states in the city of Baltimore, like the Vatican. I mean, they just come, they keep,
watch I mean, the Pope.
But we need, where's the Pope when we need him?
Personally, Ms. Clark, when they tore up Charles Street up in front of John Hopkins, You don't get the fact that most of the people that have lived in this city admired that street just the way it is. They cut down those trees and just made a big walkway to walk across the street for students. It was a travesty in some people's eyes. You should not be allowed to do that. That's part of the decent living thing. Those trees represented something personally to a lot of people. Institutions shouldn't be allowed to do that. But thank you, Mr. Steiner,
thank
for
you.
Hearing me.
Always good to hear you.
I'd like to respond by saying I was not there when that project was approved. I was having one of my sabbaticals for losing an election. And I totally agree with Clarence about the, you know, I'm sorry. And I was out with those trees as they, at their demise. But let me just mention one thing. Clarence is absolutely correct. So, for example, I'm honored to represent a Coldstream Homestead Montebello community, the largest neighborhood that I represent. It's on the east side. It's in the surrounds of City College
right.
and Clifton Park. We rezoned that entire neighborhood so that the breakup of those houses into apartments would stop, because it is now – we took the whole – we didn't wait for Transform, but we had the support of Transform planners to go ahead a couple years ago and just rezone up. In other words, which means a lower number. But anyway, we zone up the properties, every one of them, so that they could no longer be eligible for being divided into two apartments, for example. So Clarence is absolutely right, and I worry a lot that we have to use this opportunity to look at other communities and see whether we should be doing the same. And the planning people will say, you're creating nonconforming uses by upgrading them. And I say, so what? They can't be subdivided. And I think we should probably be looking in a lot of neighborhoods to see whether what exactly that point that Clarence made could be corrected while we're in the process.
Right.
I can only recommend it in my district.
So, gentlemen, look, you guys wanted to say something here.
Well, I was going to be a devil's advocate to Clarence's comment in a way, because there are some neighborhoods and houses that should remain single family just because of the size and the predominant character of the neighborhood. But there are many areas in East and West Baltimore where the size of the houses are 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 square feet that the current zoning code and this proposed new zoning code has to provide a way to build in a means to subdivide those houses into more affordable housing. There's nothing inherently wrong with apartments when the majority of the city is basically people in rental units. We can't have this prejudice against everybody has to be a homeowner. So the zoning code needs to provide the ways to facilitate those conversion of those buildings where those neighborhoods are appropriate. May not be appropriate in Coldstream Homes and Montebello, but certainly in Upton and Harlan Park and in large houses, the city needs to find a way to facilitate those.
There's a lot of phone calls here, Mayor Pastor. Please, you can jump in about it.
But we got two-story row houses. Try living next door to one that's divided into two apartments and you can't find the landlord and you really don't even know who's living there and you've been there for years. So, no, I disagree. And you're correct, though. Maybe different neighborhoods have different...
That was my whole point.
Yeah. One of the things that I think we want to separate on in this conversation is something that you just elevated up that's incredibly important. The enforcement of the laws and knowing who landlords are and holding them accountable is incredibly important. That's separate than the zoning law. And one of the things that I find us doing is trying to fix the zoning law because of an enforcement issue. And there is, again, a way here that we need to have the appropriate zoning. And, man, do we need to beef up the enforcement of it.
But you have to have the right zoning to enforce.
Yes, we need to have both. Let's make sure we do both.
Carl, you're trying to get in, and I'm going to get to the phones after Carl. Go ahead, Carl.
No, I agree. It was funny that Mary Pat said, I don't agree with you. You're right, but I don't agree with you.
No, he's right about... I was talking to Al. There are different sized houses in different neighborhoods.
That's all I said.
Okay. I agree with that.
Let me go back to the phones here. 410-319-8888. Tisha, line two, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you to your panel and for being available to the public to make comments on this issue. Something came to mind as I heard you guys talking. Will this, these new ideas, is there an aim to allow privately managed secondary schools to develop, or some might say exploit, formerly city-owned properties, which were, a lot of was open space, what they're calling campuses? That worries me because that's kind of becoming a buzzword. Used to be a school property that neighbors could walk on and was available to the area. Is it now going to be privately managed and for their private profit? Even if it's a nonprofit, it's privately owned. I know you guys understand that. And, because, you know, I personally, as an educator, I read Diane Ravitch's blog. I don't mean to put in a plug for that, but if you want the truth about, you know, investors, developers, and developing newly privatized, formerly public schools, you know, and formerly public space. So that's my question. I'm sorry if it's a little complicated. I'll hang up and listen.
All right, thank you, Tisha.
Off the air.
Most schools are – there are very few schools who have been designated with educational campuses. Most schools remain zoned residential.
Public schools, not – all the private and archdiocesan schools are designated, but the city decided to not designate the city school systems, which are publicly owned, as these campuses. So, in a sense,
it's come up.
No, but the in my district, they haven't been rezoned like the Catholic parochial schools haven't been rezoned. They're still residential.
No, the Catholic schools are.
I stand corrected.
So there are a number of things here. I'm going to go back to the phones. The people are calling in. I want to get them in here since this is their city we're talking about, city as well, but their city they're talking about. One of the issues here has to do with commercial use in neighborhoods. This is a huge issue. I mean, I live
very important, Mark.
Let's talk about what these changes might mean. I lived for 25 years in a neighborhood that wanted no commercial use, and that was in Windsor Hills. People did not want you building any stores in Windsor Hills. It was going to be a purely residential neighborhood. Sorry, you have to get in your car. If you get in your car and go over to Garrison Boulevard or someplace else to buy what you need, but you're not building it in the neighborhood. So what are we doing here?
Well, the planning department started from their sustainability section to try to look at the zoning code, I think Rich talked about, on a citywide basis, to have a more sustainable city. And what does a sustainable city mean? Well, one aspect of it is providing more mixed-use, walkable neighborhoods that have a variety of commercial uses that people can walk to rather than have to leave Windsor Hills to drive to wherever shopping center might have been built. So the new zoning code has several innovative ideas to promote that. And there is a debate because there are some people on the council that are concerned about the process through which those vacant stores, in many cases, vacant buildings, are allowed to be converted to a neighborhood commercial use.
And so what?
And I'm one of them.
Why?
Well, because it's not – I mean, basically, right now, and Carl Stokes, who's on the line –
right.
He has done what I recommended, and that is the following. If you want a house that's zoned residential that you would like as a store, it used to be a store, rezone it commercial. So everybody can see that process. Everybody can go to the hearings. Do
right.
that.
So let me ask a question, though. I mean, so this is then I'm going to go back to the phones.
Because the process whereby it happens is somebody in planning makes a decision that this would be a good candidate to be to have commercial uses.
But let me ask this question: so whether it is, whether it is Sandtown Winchester, or North Avenue, or whatever neighborhood it is, most people want to try to create neighborhoods that are, as Al was talking about, walkable, livable, so you can walk to a store,
absolutely,
get what you need and not have to
absolutely
take, right? So that's what we're talking about here, right?
Here's the difference. One of the things that Baltimore is made up of basically a lot of villages, neighborhoods, each of whom have a main street, you know, typical,
used to be that way.
They are still there, the bones are still there, and that is the place that we want to make sure it's easy. That great local commercial is there, so you can walk to get your gallon of milk, you can go out and have a dinner. You can run some errands. There's a drugstore on the commercial. That's pretty cut and dry. Let's bring back those neighborhood main streets and make them thrive.
I think that's a good point.
Okay, there's not a debate there. When it gets a little bit murkier is about more embedded in these communities where there have been traditionally the corner store that is three blocks away from the main street. And some of those in neighborhoods have become a pest, to put it mildly.
Yes.
And or worse. And so, again, making sure that I think out of this there is an appropriate process that allows the neighborhood discussion and then the enforcement so that if there's a bad actor, that gets closed down. But, again, that's proper focus, proper engagement, and then enforcement is the key to all of this. But I want to make sure that this debate – separates out those two things from the commercial main streets that we want to have thrive and these more embedded
corner stores
that are much more in part of our –
And in some of my neighborhoods, the corner stores are the corner drug stores.
Right.
And people want them to go out of existence and close as a commercial use because whatever commercial use comes has plexiglass, has people who – are not the, you know, they're not operating the kind of healthy environment they want. It's attracting people, merchants, who are behind plexiglass. And
so what we're talking about here.
The drug uses are using it as an excuse. Oh, I just went in to buy a pack of gum.
So we're coming down to, in some ways,
different neighborhoods.
Well, I'm going to put it a different way. We're coming to issues of class.
Well, no, it's not about class. It's about poverty.
That's class.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
Some of the classiest people I know are.
No, I'm not talking about that.
No,
I am. Economic class.
But
Mary Pat, stop for a second. I'm talking about economic class, the poverty in the city. You're talking about people who live in poor neighborhoods right. do not want these corner stores.
That's right.
That's what I'm agreeing with you.
And we don't want them to be able to slip slide their way right. in through conditional well, use at the zoning board.
A lot of people are calling. I really need to get the phones. Carl, a quick thought that I'm going to go to the phones here. Carl?
I'm here. I'm sorry. I'm good.
Okay. So let's go right. Rosalind, line three.
Yes. Good morning.
Welcome.
Yes. I live in the Walbrook, Windsor Hill area where there is a very diverse type of housing.
Yes.
Some are commercially zoned from years ago. And the home that I owned previously with my parents, who are deceased now, in the 60s, they were already, when purchased, converted into multiple dwellings, but they were still zoned as one family. And right now, I have an issue with some of the commercial homes in my area are being subsidized for Section 8, which is bringing in multiple families at one time. And it's very mixed. And some of the homes are abandoned and have been abandoned, and Housing Authority has not done anything to change that situation. So if I wanted to sell my home, I would have a problem because of those two factors that would impede on me selling it, as well as if I want to stay here, I'd have to deal with the diversity of the commercialism mm-hmm. and things like not just talking about liquor stores previously, but people have nursing homes, assisted living homes, or nurseries in these types of homes as well in the neighborhood. Now, I'm not bringing that down, and they're needed and they're kept up well, but not being able to zone now, I can't change my situation at all. I want to know what type of recourse do I have for something like that.
Okay. Anybody want to respond?
Well, the only thing I would say is that the planning department has a staff that has been working on this for many years, and the caller should really call the planning department. I think it's 396-4327 just to find out specifically what her home is zoned for, what it might be zoned for, and to get that type of information.
There's a great map online and on Transform Baltimore. You can go online, and there is an odd thing about something like downloadable documents. And if you go on there, there's a map, and it divides the city up into four quadrants. And that you can click on your quadrant, and it will tell you what the new zoning looks like. And if you click on your
– But a lot of people are not really fascinated with this stuff. So
no, I know. I just wanted to let people who do want to have some fun with the maps look at it.
So, Carl, the questions like this are the questions I think – they go to the heart of the matter that people are worried about the results and how to handle it.
People are worried.
Right. They certainly are.
And rightly so. I mean, basically, I don't know anything about that, the neighborhood and what she's talking about, but I think the advice is good. Call the planning department and say, look, is there any way that the zoning needs to be upgraded here so that we can stop the subdividing into of row houses? I don't know the size of the houses. I don't know. And I'm sure that whoever is the representative for that area would be happy to help to analyze this.
Carl.
Okay, so I think one of the things that Murray Pat and I am most concerned about is that originally when planning brought this over to us is that they were going to take city council out of a lot of zoning decisions. And I think neighborhoods, for transparency, and I think neighborhoods want to be sure that their elected representatives can be there for them to help get through this stuff. Oftentimes, people come before zoning or planning, and by right, they can do stuff that the neighbors at least want to know what's going on and be able to input, and in some cases, to give approval before it moves forward. And so I know that speaking for Mary Pat and myself, we're very concerned that council is that gap, that stopgap where people can get to come before it is allowed for zoning to move forward with uses that may not be conducive to a particular community.
Right.
Right. Okay.
So, So, did you, Rich, you haven't been like 20 minutes here. So, do you have anything to say about any of this we just said before we go back to
the
phones?
Sure, plenty to say. Well, as a best practice in the planning profession, you want to limit how many things like conditional uses you bring to the local elected body, whether it's a city council, county council, town council, you name it. So the types of things that you write into your zoning ordinance that are conditional uses are supposed to be conditional. They're thought through whether they make sense in that zone if they go through the extra step, which is to go before the zoning board. If you make conditional uses needing to go to the city council, then that's essentially a rezoning. The thinking here is, and again, this is a best practice, not something that just the planners and the planning commission came up in Baltimore City. This is something in the planning profession where if it's a conditional use, it's not something that's seen as needing to come before the local elected body, again, in this case, the city council. Because, again, if you're doing that, you might as well just go through a rezoning because it's essentially an analogous process. Conditional uses should fit in the zone. As long as they take that extra step to go to the Board of Zoning.
Let me just tell you a couple of conditional uses that we have now that come to the City Council. Planned unit developments. Planning decided they could do without the City Council.
Right.
Hospitals. Hospitals locating in the neighborhood come as a conditional use to the City Council. That's a pretty big thing. Mm-hmm. Adult entertainment, hey. You would probably like to be heard about that in your neighborhood. There are 882 items of categories in the current zoning code. The city council has conditional use approval for 20.
Is that, when you say current, do you mean the one that we're operating
we're using,
under, they're using, not the one that you're considering?
No, not current. That's pending.
Right. Okay.
For sure.
I wanted
and
to make sure I had the terminology.
No, current part. Right now, we have 20 conditional use permissions in the code out of 882 items that are subject to permission and use.
So let me just say that we have a lot talking about the citizens.
I'm just tired of this, though.
Let me just,
as if there was something wrong with going to your elected officials and holding them accountable.
No,
and
exactly.
Yelling at them.
We should be doing that.
I know, and people do.
So,
and I want them to continue.
410-319-8888. Let's go to Amanda. Amanda, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. I live in Remington, and I wanted to make a couple of really important distinctions about neighborhood commercial. In our community, we are putting through a community-led initiative to rezone the corner stores. And I wanted to make a couple of really big points. Number one, these are not houses that are being rezoned as businesses. They are historically commercial properties that are adjacent to houses. They're structurally designed to be commercial spaces and not homes. And also, someone else made a point about corner stores being sort of drug corners. And what's happened in my community is the corner stores have been problematic. It's true, but it's not because they're allowed to be there. It's because they're the only commercial corner commercial properties that are allowed to be there. They can't switch uses. There's no real competitive reason for them to do anything other than what they're doing, and it's, you know, I don't want to see walkability, job opportunities, and the like continue to be restricted because the current zoning is causing problems for communities. I think that's really counterproductive to the aims of Transform, and I would like to see us work on this neighborhood commercial with the aims of what we'd like in the long term and not what we're trying to prevent in the short term.
Amanda's a wonderful person.
Let me just
give the background to everybody. Up until about 4 years ago, when you had a vacant commercial storefront building throughout the city in a residential zone, you were allowed to go to the zoning board and get a specific use approval for a change to a very limited number of stores, types of stores, up until 4 years ago. 4 years ago, the city council decided to put a one-year limit so that if the store was vacant, you could not reopen it by either the zoning board, and in effect, you would then have to go to the city council to get it rezoned if you wanted to reopen it. There have been, in the last 4 years, I would guess, at least 100 or more vacant buildings that go before the zoning board. They're there every 2 weeks, that want to go in and operate, create jobs in the neighborhood, many with neighborhood support. And the zoning board says, I'm sorry, you've been vacant for a year and a half. The building has to remain vacant. That's wrong. It needs to be changed. That's what the neighborhood commercial idea is trying to do,
so
to allow these to be reopened.
It's been vacant for a year and a half. You have to remain vacant. That's the law?
That city council, in its wisdom, passed that 4 years ago to, in effect, try and go after in – Coldstream Homes of Montebello, perhaps, those stores that had became a nuisance. So rather than allow the city to deal with that issue in and of itself for the neighborhood, they changed it for the whole city. It's a problem. There are vacant buildings that need to be redone, such as Remington. And the neighborhood commercial was a very innovative suggestion by the planning department that some people are questioning. And that's unfortunate.
So, again, what we need to do is figure out the difference between enforcing the law and getting the bad actors, getting the drug dealers, getting the wrong, and making it easier for the kinds of things that neighborhoods actually want to come in. And when we just go after one or the other, we have an imbalance that causes a problem. But I think that the work that Amanda and others are doing sounds like they're coming into some real solutions. And then with enforcement, we can win.
Let me just say, please, I have to say, we only have like 20 and a half minutes left. I'm trying to get a call on here before we end. But say what you have to say.
One of the things you can do with Transform, because it's comprehensive, is you can take these properties, as the GRIA group is proposing and my colleague has introduced, like 12 different locations that are these places in Remington, to zone them commercial. You can have housing in a commercial property. You can't have commercial in a residential property. That is a great approach. I support it. That's an answer that people can use now. You got a place? Bring it in now where we can, it can be part of Transform. Rezone it. But please, and Amanda's a wonderful person. We can work with them.
I'm sorry, we're almost out of time here.
So okay.
Do we have time for another quick call? One more quick call. Line three, is it Kenneth or Keith? I can't tell. You're on the air. Welcome. We have about a minute left.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Hi.
Well, I've been listening for the whole show.
Right.
I haven't heard anything tangible or constructive that you all. Maybe I just don't understand the conversation. I'm trying to figure out what you guys are talking about. What we do have in this city is a crisis, a residential crisis. Do you agree? And what I call residential cleansing, you know, so like ethnic cleansing, we have residential cleansing, where they're pushing people out of their senior citizens' apartments, fixing these apartments up, bringing them back, and raising up their rent. And if they can't meet that new rental price, that they're just out on the street, okay? That's what you call residential clean or structural
racism.
Discrimination.
Right.
You know?
That's an issue worth a whole show.
So what I'd like to do is, this is going to go on another couple of months. I'll invite some of the folks back here. To continue discussion about zoning for our listeners to get into this as kind of on-air town meetings. This is important to get to the bottom of all of this. I want to thank our two council people, Carl Stokes, Mayor Pat Clark, for being here today.
Sure.
Appreciate it so much. I know you're on the road with your family. I appreciate you calling in, Carl.
Thanks, thank Carl.
Sure. Rich Hall, Executive Director of CPHA, Citizens Planning and Housing Association, used to be our Secretary of Planning.
Thank you.
Al Berry, Principal of AB Associates, Land Paneling Firm in Baltimore, and Drew Schmidt Perkins, Executive Director of 1,000 Friends of Maryland. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Mark.
We will put
the letter
that you all sent to the City Council, other documents, at steinershow.org, so you can see it and begin to see what's going on here so we can continue the discussion on the air. Thank you all so much.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you all for calling in today and making the show what it is and adding to the liveliness and depth of the program. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Seth Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our interns are Minifa Wilson, Calvin Perry, and Sienna Greaves. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To podcast the Mark Steiner Show, share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org, or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. From your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.